Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 9th of July. The cover story of this week's Time magazine, The Dangerous Mind of Mark Twain, How He Changed the Way We View Politics, Why He Was Ahead of His Time on Race, and What His Writing Can Teach America Today. It's part of Time's Making of America issue. It's the 7th annual issue. And the editor says he was chosen after a succession of presidents, as well as explorers Lewis and Clark and inventor Ben Franklin, because he represents a vital tradition in American politics and culture, the comedic commentator on serious matters, the funny man, our collective conscience who can utter uncomfortable truths that more solemn critics evade. Twain, the editor says, is the godfather of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, as well as the comic voice who influenced them from Lenny Bruce to Richard Pryor to Kurt Vonnegut. And Twain, with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, created the literary DNA that helped shape race relations in America over the past century. The seriously funny man. We talk about him this hour, and we have three Mark Twain scholars with us. We should have a terrific hour, and I know that many of you listen to him as well. Read him. You can't listen to him, but you read his writings. We went through a series of quotes this morning, and they just go on and on and on. It might be a good day to just read some Mark Twain quotes and have your mind stimulated and have a few laughs as well. One of our guests, and he will be with us for the whole hour, is Professor Forrest Robinson. He's in the American Studies Department at the University of California at Santa Cruz. He is a professor of American Studies and Literature, and his areas of expertise include American literature and culture, the American novel, including Twain, Melville, Faulkner, regional literature, California studies, popular culture, and American cultural theory. And Professor Forrest Robinson, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Yeah. Also joining us from Paris, I believe, is Stanford University Department of English Professor Shelley Fisher Fishkin. She is the editor of the 29-volume Oxford Mark Twain, published in 1996, The Oxford Historical Guide to Mark Twain, and Is He Dead? A New Comedy by Mark Twain. She's also a producer of the adaptation of Twain's Is He Dead?, which had its world debut on Broadway at the Lyceum Theater in 2007 and was also nominated for a Tony Award. And Professor Shelley Fisher Fishkin, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So there's Mark Twain, and it was so nice to just read this Mark Twain article, and I must say it's going to send me back to Mark Twain literature because the guy was complicated. He was funny. He was sardonic. He was political. He was irascible. There are so many nuances to him, aren't there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that there's something in him for any cast of mind, and in particular any mood that you happen to be in at any given moment.
Professor Robinson?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the more we've studied him, the more wrinkles we found, and the more he teaches us as we learn about him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any doubt that Americans continue to see themselves in him. And the essays in the Time, I don't know how Shelley feels about it, but I thought the essays in Time were awfully good.
I thought so, too.
In bringing all that to bear. Yes.
Yeah, I agreed. I thought they did a terrific job. I think, in particular, I think Roy Blunt's essay did a great job of emphasizing that one of the reasons why Twain lasts and why we still care so much about him and have so much to learn from him is his social critique, which is something that often gets lost in the shuffle when people think of white fence painting in Hannibal, which is something that happens this time of year at the 4th of July celebrations in Hannibal. But there's a lot more to Twain than Tom Sawyer and fence painting scenes. And the social critique, I think, is one of the reasons why many of us value him as much as we do.
Yeah. Was it unusual for a guy to give such social critique on American adventures or misadventures abroad, for him to talk about race relations, for him to take on the church that the way that he did without offending a large number of Americans?
Yes, I think it was. And I think there were certainly plentiful other people who were critical of what the United States was involved in around the turn of the century. Shelley and I did a conference on that topic not so long ago. he was careful in ways. He didn't say everything he believed, and he didn't publish everything he wrote, because he was aware that there was a limit to what he could say. I mean, on the topic of lynching, for example, I mean, he wrote a very powerful critique of lynching and didn't publish it because he realized it would be just too inflammatory in the South. So he recognized the limits to what he could do, but he also, I think, probably operated within a wider frame. There was more tolerance for what he had to say than for others. He was, you know, I think we're pretty clear now that at about 1900, Mark Twain was, his popularity exceeded the popularity of almost anybody else in the country. He was more visible than just about anyone, except perhaps Teddy Roosevelt, and Teddy Roosevelt he loathed as a fraud and an example of what Tom Sawyer would have been like had he grown up. So he had enormous public visibility and authority on social issues, and he was perfectly willing to use it.
And how did he get all that visibility? People just read him in newspapers?
Shelley, why don't you go with that?
Well, he was, I have to say that calling him our first rock star, as Ron Powers did, or our first national celebrity, as Time did, makes a great deal of sense, because one thing that he has in common with all subsequent celebrities is that he was always extremely hospitable to the press, and he was always very happy to grant interviews. In addition to writing popular works that people loved, he was very happy to talk about them on any occasion to journalists, and that endeared him to the public. He also knew exactly how far he could push his critique without losing that audience, and that may be part of why he didn't publish all of the more hard-hitting comments he made in later years. But he did grow increasingly willing to publish very hard-hitting commentaries in his later career that he might not have dared to publish early on. And I think he became more outspoken as he became more outraged, as he viewed what his country was doing abroad, as he viewed the ways in which America became sullied with the same imperialist lusts that he saw Europe sullied with. And he also became increasingly outspoken about the role of religion in supporting all of those misadventures abroad.
Mm-hmm. And if you would, tell us a little more, because I wasn't real familiar with this essay, and I need to go back and read it because it sounds so profound, the lynching critique, in which he tries to take on the issue that I've always wondered about. How can people stand and watch somebody being lynched and cheer for it? And he gets to, it's a very long, interesting essay in which he says things that, you know, give you an understanding of why people could do that. Right. And he also takes on religion at the same time. Could one of you describe that essay?
Do you want to take that one for us?
Well, I can, if you like. I think you have to, the very good question is his question about how people could look on and watch something as horrible as a lynching. And I think that question goes to the very center of his social analysis, which really does, in a sense, I mean, the first time we see it, the example of the fence painting in Hannibal, even though it may seem trivial, it illustrates a central point, which is that Tom Sawyer succeeds in convincing his juvenile peers that work is play.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that reality is negotiable. And Clemens actually says in Tom Sawyer that he'd learned a great rule of human behavior, which was that if you could make people think that work was play, you would have great success in life. And what I think at the center of Mark Twain's whole critique is a sense that human perception of reality is utterly malleable and easily influenced, so long as you understand what it is that will make people believe things. And basically, what he thought was that people would believe things if you made it attractive to them in material terms, or if it promised to be flattering to their vanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that so people, his sense was that people really wanted to be liked and accepted by other people, and to be rich. Well, his notion was that people would believe almost anything if it served their interest to do so. And he saw in lynching that otherwise very good people would stand by and watch horrible things happen, because the alternative would be to stand up and resist and thereby be isolated from the community of their of their fellows, of their supporters.
I think
an essay called Cornpone Opinions, which basically offers this analysis. I mean, broadly speaking, says there are none but cornpone opinions. And that is to say that opinions are formed in response to wherever you get your cornpone. Whoever's feeding you can tell you what to believe. I really think that from the beginning is his understanding, and it just becomes more articulate toward the end of his career. In other essays, too, like The Person Sitting in Darkness or My First Lie and How I Got Out of It, those kinds of essays are ones in which he develops this fundamental understanding of human nature. And it's very important that he writes in the United States of Lynchdom that the moral sense teaches us what is right and how to avoid it when unpopular. Mm-hmm. Right? Those are his words. So we know what's right, and yet we know that when something that is right is unpopular, the moral sense will show us how to avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important with him, and a key to, I think, his popularity is that he numbers himself among the deceived, that he never occupies sort of moral high ground. He invariably will come around and show in various ways that he is himself as susceptible to this, that he is as vain, he is as loving of, Shelley says he loved the press. He did. He loved all that attention, and he'd be the first to admit it.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add to that, Shelley?
Well, yes, I agree with everything that Forrest has said, and I think that My First Lie and How I Got Out of It, an essay that Forrest mentioned, is really important here, because Twain coined a concept which I think really needs to be much more familiar more broadly, which is the lie of silent assertion, the silent assertion that nothing's going on that anyone needs to be concerned about. And he is really emphasizing that there are lies of silent assertion. These are the kinds of lies that allowed people to pretend that nothing wrong was going on when they were living in a society that tolerated lynchings, or that allowed them to pretend that they weren't part and parcel of an obscene foreign policy when, in fact, they had elected the government that was pursuing that foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Twain wasn't going to let us or himself get away with that, and his contention was that these lies of silent assertion are the bad ones. They're the ones you really have to look out for, the big lies, the lies that pretend that you're not complicitous in something that's really dreadful. And I think that that's really a message that we need to hear today. One of his pieces, which I was disappointed did not feature in the Time essays, but is extremely relevant today, is a piece he wrote called The War Prayer that he wrote in 1905, which was a satire on invoking religion as you go off to war.
Mm.
And he had really an extraordinary image that he projects in that piece of a man who interrupts a service being held in a church in which the soldiers are being sent off to war, and the ministers and their parents and everyone in the community is very proud of them and has just given a long prayer wishing them victory in battle. And then a stranger shows up and says that God's heard your prayer and he's going to grant it so long as you want all of it granted, because there's a silent one that goes along with the one you've spoken. And just, you know, a brief quote from the silent prayer, the unspoken prayer is, O Lord, our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with ourselves, with our shells. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Turn them out ruthless with little children to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst. So, you know, he's very aware of all that we have to pretend we don't see to engage in the actions that we do engage in that have moral consequences that are absolutely intolerable if we face them. And a lot of what he did was force us to face them.
Right. He also did some writing. The piece was talking about Abu Ghraib and people writing about that. But he also wrote some scathing things about torture, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
This is in the stuff on the Philippines.
In the Philippines, right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes, he was absolutely horrified by the behavior of our troops in the Philippines and what we were doing to basically Filipino freedom fighters who were largely Muslim, who he'd initially thought, we were helping to set free from Spain. But as soon as he realized that the Spanish-American War and the Philippine-American War was all about our substituting the U.S. for Spain as an influence over the Philippines, he was horrified. And he, basically it was waterboarding that was being used to try to get confessions. And he was very skeptical of what you would get using a technique like that. And it was that specific technique that was being used.
Right. And he wrote about it, that you can get anything from anybody if you use those techniques, right? I mean, he's speaking to a modern audience.
Yes.
With all of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Somebody in the piece said that Mark Twain produced one of the wisest meditations on race in all of American literature. Would you both describe it as such?
I would.
Probably for different reasons.
Oh, good. Let's hear them. Okay.
Shelley, you go first.
Well, I think that that the book is a really profound satire on the ways in which people have blinded themselves to, to their own nature and what it means to be good. And it's a book in which the most admirable character in the book is treated as the same way that his mistress's pigs and chickens are treated. And the people who view themselves as fine, upstanding, righteous folks are perpetrating this horrible crime of daily depriving this really admirable human being of his freedom. So it's a book that challenges us to look at our society and ask whether, in fact, things may still be topsy-turvy, that people may be accepting as fine and good and just behavior that in fact is not. I think it also is a book, it's not, sometimes it's called, anti-slavery. Well, that's really kind of preposterous because slavery had ended a couple of decades before the book came out. It's a book that is challenging the ways in which American society tolerates racism, and I think in many ways we can view it as a satire on the way we botched the whole enterprise of freeing the slaves. And Twain was looking at the rollback in black rights that was happening as he wrote the novel in the post-Reconstruction era, and in some ways it's one of the best testimonies to how bizarre and crazy that period was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with all of that, absolutely. My sense of it also, though, is that, in 1907, in his autobiography, Mark Twain wrote, "In myself I find in bigger, little proportions every quality and every defect that is findable in the mass of the race." And he went on to say, "The human race is a race of cowards." Hmm. And I am not, not only marching in that procession, but carrying a banner, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, he's always self-implicating.
Mm-hmm.
He's always he ends even the piece on My First Lie. He ends by saying, I know the lie is there, but let somebody else worry about it. That's where he ends. In other words, I'm going to retreat into the comfort of this lie of silent assertion. Something of that, I think, also is going on in Huckleberry Finn, and to this extent that if you think of, Huckleberry Finn is by far the most popular of the canonical novels in the entire American canon. That is to say, it's the only one of our really great novels that's read by millions and millions and millions of people in this country and all over the rest of the world. Most of the other great novels are stuff for college courses. And it is quite an extraordinary fact, because the novel is about a subject that has been as painful for Americans as any that you can imagine. That's to say, race and slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So the question that one must ask about that novel is, how in the name of God did it manage to become so popular?
Yes,
consider that its topic is one that's so absolutely unpopular,
right,
with Americans. And I tend to answer that question by saying that it provides Americans with a narrative about race and slavery that they can live with, right? And it does that by creating the impression that an itinerant, illiterate, rather, a really strange boy, white boy, is able, using the resources of his own good nature, to transcend the issue of race and slavery. a boy raised in the very midst of that culture. That's a preposterous proposition on the face of it, but it's also one that's not borne out by the novel. Huck doesn't transcend race and slavery. Huck doesn't ultimately rise out of his racial attitudes, and at the end of the novel, he rather than, I mean, we like to think of the novel's ending with Huck sort of saving Jim, but in fact, at the end of the novel, Jim has been taken care of, I suppose, and Huck lights out for the territory because he hates civilization.
Hmm.
In his mind, the problem is far from resolved.
Yeah, I don't think that Twain means us to assume. I mean, I think that a lot of critics in the 20th century liked to give it the reading that Forrest is suggesting, and I agree that is not a really adequate reading, that Huck does not transcend the racism of his society, and that, in fact, nobody in the book does. And that's why the book remains so powerful and engaging, because it allows us to look at a blindness that pervaded a society and that in some ways still pervades our society. But it's the criticism that makes it live. I mean, this is a sense where I think Twain has a great deal in common with other 20th century critics like Richard Pryor, or like John Stewart, for that matter, who aren't proposing solutions but are extremely deft at illuminating the critique, at showing the problem, at pointing out our failings and our hypocrisies. It doesn't mean that they've figured out how to get out of the problem. It just means that they're very good at showing the ways in which we are not doing what we pretend to be doing or what we like to think of ourselves as doing.
We need to pause for a moment. We'll return. We have many people who want to speak with both of you, so we'll take phone calls momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Mark Twain is the cover of Time magazine, which is nice to see, the annual Making of America issue, focusing on the dangerous mind of Mark Twain and how he changed the way we view politics, why he was ahead of his time on race, and what his writing can teach America today. We have two Twain scholars with us right now, Professor Forrest Robinson, Professor of American Studies and Literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Professor Shelley Fisher Fishkin, who is Professor of English and Director of American Studies at Stanford University. Roy Blount will be joining us momentarily. He's an author and a humorist and wrote one of the essays in the Time magazine piece, America's Original Superstar. To you in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we're going to welcome phone calls. Shelley, I know you're in Paris right now. What do you think about this quote? In Paris, they simply stared when I spoke to them in French. I never did succeed in making those idiots understand their language. The guy could be pretty darn funny, right?
Well, and pretty darn accurate.
Let's go. You have time for a couple phone calls, Shelley? I don't
sure.
know. Okay,
yeah,
good.
Certainly.
All right. Rick from La Crosse. Hi.
A very good morning. You've mentioned some just great essays all the way from The War Prayer, The United States of Lynchardom. One of the most famous anti-imperialist essays of all time, To the Person Sitting in Darkness, where he criticizes European and American imperialism in China and the Philippines, and he suggests that the white stripes be changed to black on the American flag, and the Jolly Roger be put where the stars are, you know, the pirate flag of the U.S., meaning that the U.S. has public and private morals. But my favorite is one that reminds me of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Correspondents' Association Dinner, Chapter 72 of his autobiography, where he talks about a banquet of an organization that called itself the Ends of the Earth Club. Chairman, retired regular army officer of high grade, proclaimed in a loud voice and with fervency, "We are of the Anglo-Saxon race, and when the Anglo-Saxon wants a thing, he just takes it." And he says, Mark Twain says, that that utterance was applauded to the echo. And he says, the soldier man's great utterance, interpreted by the expression which he put into it, meant, in plain English, the English and the Americans are thieves, highwaymen, pirates, and we are proud to be of the combination. You know, it was like, you can't get a better statement of American exceptionalism than that. And I'm a Mark Twain fan and admirer. There's just, Mark Twain was one of the first anti-imperialists, along with Moorfield's story, the first president of the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
And he just had some very, very, very choice things to say about U.S. imperialism around the world, in the Philippines, you know, and he made a very pointed criticism of the U.S. playing the European game, or as George Carlin mm-hmm. would say, playing the part of Europe Junior.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to you, Shelley, because you're not with us too much longer. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's a wonderful quote, and I think you're absolutely right that one of the subjects that he is most insightful on is the ways in which American exceptionalism is a fraud, that in fact we are not exceptional in the ways we like to think we are, and particularly he had bought into that himself and was really very disillusioned when he saw us behaving just the way all the European nations behaved that he had been looking down on. But, you know, to be fair, he generalized and made the same comments about more broadly as well. For example, he referred to patriotism as, he said, quote, it's a word which always commemorates a robbery. There isn't a foot of land in the world mm-hmm. which it doesn't represent the ousting and re-ousting of a long line of successive owners who each in turn as patriots with proud swelling hearts defended it against the next gang of robbers mm-hmm. who came to steal it and did mm-hmm. and became swelling hearted patriots in their turn. So I think that you know, his immediate inspiration was watching what Americans were doing, but he recognized that the whole nature of patriotism involves robbery wherever one encounters it. And I think that's a really interesting insight, and it's one that you know, it might be worth sharing with students more often, getting them to think about, because it's not, you know, it's not a side of him. The essays that you mentioned, the essays we've been discussing, the ones that Time Magazine featured, these are not dimensions of Twain that are as well known as they need to be, and I think they're so important.
Mm-hmm. And how did you take him to your heart and head, Shelley?
Well, I think actually it was a brilliant assignment by a high school English teacher
really?
Who asked me to write a paper on how Twain used irony to attack racism in Huck Finn. And I had never really been asked to get between the lines of a text before and really see, you know, how an author was achieving a larger end like that. And I found it really, really very, very exciting. And very interesting, because it was so artful, because Twain didn't allow anyone in the book to recognize that the society was topsy-turvy and the moral values were wrong, and any time your conscience spoke up, it was going to be a problem. But I think it was really his, you know, his power as a writer to tackle topics that are perennially riveting and troubling, and he just does it so well. I mean, he said, you know, the difference between the lightning and the lightning, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug.
Hmm.
You know, whatever he wrote about in really sharply honed, flawless American prose, and I find that's always exhilarating to encounter.
Yeah, it's great to read. Shelley, thanks very much. Have fun in Paris.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sparking this discussion.
Oh, yeah, it's our pleasure. We're having a great time. Shelley Fisher-Fishkin, Professor of English and Director of American Studies at Stanford University, joining us by phone from Paris for this first half hour of the program. Forrest Robinson will continue to stay with us, Professor of American Studies and Literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we are now joined by Roy Blunt. He is an author, humorist, president of the Authors Guild. He has written introductions to several Mark Twain collections and books, and for six editions, actually, of Twain's work. And he's also the author of a piece you'll want to go to right now, which is in the Time Magazine, a cover story on Mark Twain, America's Original Superstar. Mark Twain skewered the powerful, mocked the pious, and helped change a nation. And welcome to you, Roy.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, nice to have you with us. What does you talk early on in your piece about what does Twain have to do that speaks to, what does he say that speaks to the issues of our day?
Well, I mean, he came out against waterboarding, for instance. I mean,
yeah, right.
Imperialism, which are certainly matters. I mean, he explicitly talked about use of what they call the water cure against prisoners in the Philippines to force, and said that, pointed out that, that people will say anything if they're being tortured, but you don't know whether it's the truth or not, which I wish that the current administration had read that before they embarked on their recent tactics of, you know, of questioning. And he also, I mean, here we are in Iraq, just sort of being bumptiously invading a country and getting in deep trouble in the process of it. There again, Mark Twain would have been opposed.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask both of you, Forrest, starting with you. Do you think that he got sadder? He lost a couple daughters. Do you think that he a darker Mark Twain emerged toward the end of his life?
No question that that's true, although I don't think it was a break. I think it was an evolution. The kinds of insights into human nature and human behavior that he ended his life with are ones that are present really quite from the beginning. You can see all of this embryonically in the earliest Innocents Abroad and Roughing It. But there's no question at all that it did become much darker toward the end of his life. And interestingly, that's the part of his life that's least studied. It's the part we have displayed the least interest in knowing more about, which is to say we've been reluctant to give up on a certain kind of image of Mark Twain as a genial, funny man.
Yeah, when you go to Hannibal Tom Sawyer days, you see a lot of jumping frogs and the Becky Thatcher bookshop, but you don't hear much reference to the war prayer and that sort of thing.
That's right. It's good. I think Time did a very good thing in bringing this into the foreground, and I think all the essays are terrific, and it's timely and accurate and right.
And I don't know whether you've missed it yet, but you know, the Mark Twain House in Hartford is in jeopardy. They need to raise some money somehow to pay their mortgage. So there is that little news peg there that somebody needs to rally around his house to keep it from going. You know, for a long time it was a boarding house, and then it fell into disrepair, and people finally put a lot of money into restoring it, and it's a great place to visit. It's full of all sorts of mementos and his pool table, and it's also sort of spooky in there because, you know, his favorite daughter died in the house, but it certainly ought to be preserved, and I hope, I don't know where the money's coming from, but they're eager to find somebody to refinance them.
What happened to it? How did it fall into disrepair?
Oh, in disrepair, in the old days, it was bought. They couldn't stand to live there anymore because of the memories, and so they rented it out for a while, and then finally they sold it. It was owned at one point by Richard Bissell, whose son, Richard Bissell Jr., became a CIA, big person in the CIA, and who, in fact, planned the Bay of Pigs invasion. Richard Bissell Jr. grew up in that house.
Oh my gosh.
I think after that family, nobody lived in it for a while, and it went through various incarnations and ran down. But for the last several years, it's been maintained as a tourist destination.
Yeah.
But they sort of overextended themselves
and created the problems with the house, though, is that it,
and like so many mortgages today, they can't pay for paying at the moment.
Right. Roy, didn't you play billiards with Garrison Keillor in that house?
I did on Mark Twain's table. Garrison actually broke one of his billiard balls. I promised not to tell anybody that, but it in fact happened. We shot pool on it with new balls on his table. It was a privilege. That's all I can say. And also, you could, since it's on the radio, you could lie about how many balls you were sinking.
You can make up a whole new game.
Certainly privileged lying, so I think he would enjoy that.
Yeah. You know, who wrote, I don't know if you wrote this, Roy, or not, but let me ask Forrest about this. Somewhere in the article it says, and I find this so hard to believe, that Mark Twain never laughed.
Never laughed?
Never left.
Oh, I don't believe that.
There from the editor of the New American Review, who said that he had known him for years and had never seen him smile. That he had just always had this deadpan.
Huh.
Oh, the deadpan thing. Well, there's that. But I mean, we know that he was laughed a lot as a young man. It may be that he became grimmer in his late years, but he still enjoyed a good joke.
I
think maybe that's a reference to his famous deadpan delivery,
mm-hmm.
which is all part of that kind of humor. Consider that. I mean, just a point I would make about the house is that the problem with the house is that it's ultimately kind of insupportable. It's a monstrosity. It's a huge monument to Gilded Age values.
Huh.
I mean, Mark Twain he knew very well he wasn't exempt from the sort
right.
of display and the love of money that he criticized so constantly in his career, particularly in the Gilded Age. I mean, he names the period in American history of the Gilded Age, the post-Reconstruction period, post-Civil War period. But Mark Twain was up to his ears in the very venality and selfishness and display, mm-hmm. love of display, mm-hmm. that he criticized. And the house, I think, is probably the best monument to that. It's an enormous, garish, house, and it will be difficult to pay to support it because it's so big and complicated.
Yeah, massive contradictions, huh? We're going to take phone calls for our guests, and we'll go back to phone calls in just a moment. 800-486-8655. We also have some emails that have come in, and did I give you the Milwaukee line? 414-227-2050. We have two guests with us. Roy Blunt is here now. Roy wrote one of the pieces that is in the Time magazine, and it really is a good article. I'm happy to hear that all of the guests who are Mark Twain scholars think that what Time did was good. It's chock full of information, and Roy wrote one of the pieces that's in Time. He's an author, humorist, current president of the Authors Guild. Forrest Robinson, professor of American Studies and Literature, University of California, Santa Cruz, who teaches American literature and culture and teaches a great deal of Mark Twain. Oh, we have so many of you who want to talk, so don't worry, we'll be with you in just a minute, I promise, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let us return to phone calls. We have many of them. Rich is next from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi. It's good hearing that Twain got grimmer in his older age, because I certainly wouldn't want to be left alone. But I'm joining late, and maybe this has already been covered. But I was fortunate enough to have teachers who pointed my way to, I guess, what is considered one of the latest in publishing in Twain's life, that is The Mysterious Stranger. And I was really struck at an early age by what a division there was between how Twain was represented to me as sort of a folksy Will Rogers kind of character, you know, who never met a man he didn't like sort of thing, and deep-thinking philosopher about organized religion, and that in this age when we have witnessed Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and Jimmy Swaggart and the Crystal Cathedral and a whole raft of other people who are going to save us by building their own empires, I'm just wondering if there's anything in this Time retrospective on Twain that really focuses late Mark Twain.
I think you do some of that, Roy, in your piece.
Yeah, I think in my piece mostly focuses on the late writing, which is about imperialism and was angrier than the earlier writing and was irreligious. And he really disliked Christianity. I mean, he really said all sorts of things. Somebody asked him, Andrew Carnegie, who was a friend, acquaintance of his, said, "What about this notion that America is a Christian nation?" And Mark Twain said, "Carnegie, so is hell." Which was a good point. He got angrier and angrier as he got older. And the piece I wrote is mostly about those, about the stuff he wrote about later to around the turn of the century, around 1900, when he returned to this country from abroad and hit the ground criticizing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich, very much for the call. We have an email from Alice saying she would like for you to comment on her favorite short story of Mark Twain, A Dog's Life, which is, she said, a very simple title. It's a remarkable short story, memorable, and will bring more than a tear to any dog lover's eye. Either of you quite familiar with that one?
Yeah, it's sad, all right.
It's sad?
Yeah.
I can remember shedding a tear over it myself. I can't tell you much more.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
It's sad. He liked cats better, really, I think.
Yeah, but he goes to that sort of sad dog stories in several different places. If I could just say something a little bit about the question
sure.
about religion. I mean, Mark Twain was, of course, very hostile to what he perceived accurately, I think, as the hypocrisy of much Christian profession in the world. I mean, he saw that it was often a front for greed and so on. But on the other hand, he was very aware that humans required, in a sense, I mean, he saw Christianity as an illusion, but he recognized that human beings required illusions in order to get along in the world. All of the women in his family suffered terribly from what was called then varieties of hysteria. And to all of them, he recommended what was known as mind cure.
Hmm.
And mind cure was a kind of form of positive thinking. A kind of as-if thinking, think as though, and you'll feel better. It didn't work very well for them. He loathed Mary Baker Eddy, but he recognized in Christian Science a powerful sort of anodyne to the woes of the people in the United States and in the world at the end of the 19th century.
Interesting.
And he said she had discovered something that was very powerful, which is that if you tell people, if you create a positive world for people, it'll make them feel better.
Hmm.
Yeah,
he didn't. He didn't buy into the illusions, but on the other hand, he recognized the necessity.
Mm-hmm. Thing is a lie. You can't help lying, and it's all.
I'm sorry, Roy. We missed that. What were you saying?
He was had a very kind of postmodern attitude toward objective fact. You know, he said everything was a lie, and you can't help lying, and it's all. People are making things up all the time, and it's not. You know, everything is subjective, and therefore. If it makes you feel good, there's nothing to be said for it. On the other hand, he would just rage against the inconsistencies of religion. For he said that he wrote a little essay about flies, in which he said if there were a benevolent God, he would not have created the fly. And he goes on to talk about all the flies on starving children's lips he's seen around the world, and the utter uselessness of flies. And if a human being had designed the fly, had gone to all the trouble of designing the fly, we would hate him.
I'll have to read that one. Did he write anything on ticks?
I don't know anything about ticks.
I think Roy's right that, and Shelley mentioned this earlier too, that Mark Twain was awfully good at describing our problem, but not so good at imagining solutions. And I think ultimately the reason for that is that I don't think he thought there were any.
Yeah,
I really think his vision was very dark in that respect. Mm. That the human condition was desperate.
Mm.
And, and that's why he's so funny. I think is that he did have a kind of desperate sense of life, and it required a real leap out into the. Humor to salve the pain of life, but he didn't. His humor is never just frivolous. Well, sometimes it's frivolous, but it's so frivolous it's almost serious. But humor is always tied up in a sense of loss and regret and pain.
Yeah, let's go to Ed from Madison. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Okay, just to be quick, I was just wondering if any of the guests are aware of an article that Mr. Twain wrote. The article is called Concerning the Jew,
yeah.
And it's the most very, very anti-Semitic article.
Well, it's not intended to be. I mean, it's certainly embarrassing today, but he was trying to... I mean, he was arguing things like, you know, the Jews are basically smarter than everybody else.
And well, in this particular article, he was extremely
he was very
anti-Semitic. I could quote
Wait.
What he is saying. Later on, years later, he retracted these statements. And but what I'd like to know is if you're aware of when this article was written and in what media. Was it some kind of a journal?
Okay.
To know when he was this statement was retracted?
Okay.
I don't know about the retraction. The concerning the Jews was written around the turn of the century. The exact date I can't give you. And I think you know, Shelley's also written, Shelley Fishkin, who was on earlier, has written about the anti-Semitic elements in the essay. But I think Roy's right that at the time it was extraordinary for the way in which it came out and espoused and defended and celebrated Jews, that it had elements in it that strike us as anti-Semitic today, it isn't surprising. Mark Twain, by today's standards, would also be a racist. But those kinds of accusations are always kind of ahistorical. That is to say, that they don't put him into his own context. In his own context, he was a very, very liberal.
Yeah, and he defended Dreyfus and praised Zola for defending Dreyfus and hated for one good reason for hating the French was the Dreyfus affair, which was so he was against the French anti-Semitism certainly, and as I say, and as far as he was, and that's I think that's one of the reasons he stays alive is that he's not purely right on everything. He gets his head down into things and writes things which are partly embarrassing today, but which got at the way he felt about things and didn't try to be you know sort of antiseptically correct.
Right. Thanks, Ed, for the call. Rick is next from Merrill. Hi, Rick.
Oh, I'd like to give my favorite Twainism and then just make a comment. Here it comes. Congress is America's only native criminal class.
Yeah.
And what I'd like to mention, the fact you were talking about lynching, I believe that the worst year for lynching in the Old South was 1800. Now we have a national murder rate of something around 17,000, if you can believe the crime statistics from the FBI, which is a really, really big stretch. And I just wondered, you know, Congress has passed all these gun control laws starting back in the 1930s to deal with this problem. That's really all been a terrific success, hasn't it?
I'm trying to think of something that Mark Twain wrote about gun control. I can't think offhand, but I don't think that's true that 1800 was the high point of lynching. I think it was much later that lynching reached its peak.
Right.
Yeah. See, I think Mark Twain would have great fun as a comedian with the current debates about gun law.
I mean,
because the contradictions are so glaring and the inconsistencies and the irrationality, in my opinion, of the whole thing is so obvious. That he would run with it. I mean, you can see some anticipation of it in the Grangerford Shepherdson feuding in Huckleberry Finn, where these families go on killing each other back and forth, generation after generation, and they can't even remember what it is that they're fighting about.
Right.
But if you put guns into their hands, they will, of course, go on killing each other.
Yeah.
And journalists wrote something about journalism in Tennessee, too, where people are dodging a lot of bullets. I mean,
that's right.
Whenever people are shooting in Mark Twain's work, it's not any fun and it's pretty stupid.
Yeah.
So what do you both think? We have about a minute left. Do you think that people like Stewart and Colbert and Marr and others spend their evenings reading Mark Twain?
I don't know. I'm trying. Generally, when funny people are asked who they think is funny, they will mention Mark Twain. And I've always thought that. An interesting thing about Mark Twain is that you can't parody Mark Twain. You can't, do a send-up of Mark Twain because he's funnier than you are to begin with. And also, it's like parodying your parents. You know, he's like the voice of American comedy, and there's no way to get around it. You just have to try to do his, try to continue the line of comedy that he started.
Yeah.
I think that they are. I don't think they're directly drawing on it, but I would say this that Mark Twain tells us constantly that America is not exceptional in the way it would like to be. That is to say that it's better, morally superior to the other countries in the world. But I think that he would agree that we're exceptional in the relentlessness with which we make that point about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's the strain in his humor that comes down to is that this is a country in which you can say, as often and as bitterly and as darkly as you want to, how wrong we are and how hypocritical we can be. And,
he
welcome that.
He admitted to being wrong a lot of the time himself.
And, mm-hmm. and constantly he did that himself. And I think that's our only hope. Is not, we're never going to stop being wrong, but if we can just not forget to remember that and to constantly bring ourselves back around to that, we'll be fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It was a wonderful hour. Thanks.
Yeah. It's good to talk to you, Forrest.
Really, thank you. Lovely. I'm a great admirer of yours and another time.
Well, me too. Yeah, let's do it. Good.
All right. Let's get together. And this is all – everybody wants to go to – I want to go to Mark Twain now, which is what I'll do. I'll go to the library today. Time Magazine has their annual Making of America issue, which prompted our conversation today. And it's on the dangerous mind of Mark Twain, how he changed the way we view politics, why he was ahead of his time on race, what his writing can teach America today. One of the pieces contributed by Roy Blunt, who's an author humorist, current president of the Authors Guild. We also thank Forrest Robinson, professor of American Studies and Literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Shelley Fisher Fishkin, joining us earlier from Stanford University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this great hour and to John Anderson for on-air production. Great conversation ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.